It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the movie Black Panther will be the first major superhero movie with an African protagonist and a mostly African and African-American cast. We talk about what that representation means for audiences around the United States. First, the suspect behind yesterday's school shooting in Parkland, Florida, was ordered held without bond today on 17 counts of premeditated murder. As the story unfolded over the last 24 hours, a portrait of the alleged perpetrator has started to emerge. Online, the 19-year-old suspect frequently posed with weapons on Instagram and has reported to the FBI over comments he made on the video channel YouTube. Today, the Anti-Defamation League said that it had confirmed that the suspect was a member of a Florida-based white nationalist group and had trained with them. Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Brian, from what we know at this point, and of course details still keep coming in the days after a tragedy like this, what are your thoughts based on what we know now?
Well, it's unfortunate that we have the confluence of two terrible things going on in our society. One are these mass shootings, in particular at schools, and the other comes from the story that you just broke of my colleagues at the ADL finding that this particular assailant had connections to a white supremacist group, the Republic of Florida.
What do we know about violent activity associated with groups like that one?
Great question. And, you know, and what we have, unfortunately, over the last few years, it is a string of homicides done by people in their 20s or early 30s, people who are unstable, disenfranchised, who got vacuumed in to the white nationalist movement. And we've seen an emboldenment of these groups, not only with leafleting on college campuses and spreading banners across interstates, as they're doing here in California and elsewhere in the country, but also something else, and bear with me on this. 36% of Americans say whites are under attack, and about 14 to 16% say that whites are under attack and people of color aren't. So we're dealing at a time now where young people are reporting very high rates of depression with respect to social surveys, and we have unstable time bombs who are being harnessed by these hate groups. And we've seen killings just recently in New Mexico involving a school shooting and a bigot, as well as apparently what we saw in Florida. So we've had a string of homicides that have been taking place, and what I think that is being missed is we spend a lot of time, as does our center, on violent Salafist jihadists. But our center has said we have the most diverse threat matrix that we've had in some time. And it's not only violent Salafist jihadists, it's also people from the ultra-far-right, alt-right, white supremacist, and anti-government world as well.
When we look at federal anti-terrorism efforts, do you see much focus on these groups on the extreme right, or are we focused more on the, as you mentioned, Salafist Islam threat?
I think, unfortunately, we are looking at only one part of the threat matrix when we should spend more attention looking at the diverse threat matrix that we have, which is the most diverse that we've had in decades and includes this kind of hybrid of unstable, disenfranchised people who are prone to violence in general and then catapulted to it by these ideologies and subcultures. And let me just give you an example. A group that I met with last week here in Los Angeles, Life After Hate, had a six-figure grant that was given to them and then rescinded with the new administration. We've also seen data come out from the government which tilts the picture more toward international terrorism and violent Salafist jihadists, which are indeed a threat. This is all fluid at this time as we're seeing changes in Syria, but also here domestically, we have a very divided, polarized, and politically entrenched populace. And one of the things that our research has shown is that we've seen violence increase among around election time. We've also seen more white nationalist mega rallies, those rallies of over 100 or more, in the last 2 to 3 years than we saw in the last 10 to 20, as well as greater internet involvement, which targets a younger demographic, which includes students and college students.
Talking to Brian Levin from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino about yesterday's mass shooting at a Florida school. Brian, let's talk about prevention. And it seems like this would be really hard to do, even if you profiled, narrowing down to young, white, with extremist views, depressed, with pictures with guns on social media. Most of the people, even fitting that fairly narrow category, are probably never going to be involved in this kind of violence, right? So how do you figure out who the real positives are, the one that you have to focus on if you're in law enforcement?
Well, it's really hard, and the Secret Service tried to attempt to come up with a profile. There really isn't one single profile, but there are certain characteristics that we look at. As you said, people who feel they're disenfranchised, people who talk about violence. The other thing, too, that I think is a bit of a myth is that people snap. Oftentimes, this occurs in an incremental yet firm trajectory over time. And as we saw, this particular assailant actually posted in social media last year about school shootings. So I think what we have to do is make sure that if, as a citizen did in Mississippi, if you see something, say something. But I also think we have to have greater interagency coordination with respect to these kind of things, particularly because this assailant posted under his own name.
Do you see similarities between the Salafist jihadist terrorist attacks that we see sometimes and white supremacist ones, similar tactics, similar run-ups, similar profiles or types of people who go a very different way ideologically but maybe end up in the same place committing an act of violence?
That's a great question. And one of the things that our center does, because we look at all these different groups, is look at these commonalities. The first thing I would say is there's a targeting of a younger male demographic. There's also targeting of females, but in different ways. Also, these groups maintain training camps, whether it's in Syria or in Texas or in Florida, as we've seen. We had a homicide here in Southern California where it turned out that the assailant allegedly went to a training camp by a neo-Nazi group. The other thing is look at the groups and whether they are in-group oriented and encourage a subculture of violence, either rhetorically or through training. And lastly, if people become withdrawn and they seem to have a fixation with weaponry, one last thing that we see is a lot of times these groups have a promise of machismo and some kind of misogyny associated as well. The role of the warrior male protecting females from this culture of depravity. And that's true whether it's the Daesh partisans or people in the Klan and white supremacist and neo-Nazi world as well.
Brian, I wonder if you can leave us with some thoughts on how to talk about cases like this in the media. Because I've seen arguments that when you use words like shooter or lone wolf, that can be glamorizing. When you focus on new records in body counts and something like that, that inspires other people of similar mindsets to try to top that, which is bizarre, but apparently happens. How do you want to see us talk about this?
What I think is to do what you're doing, to tone down some of the rhetoric which makes these people look like they're characters out of a James Bond movie. In fact, often they're the opposite. These are people who are hobbled by some kind of life event, some kind of failure in relationships, as well as lack of access, and what I mean is they may not seek it out, to mental health clinicians. And once you connect those people with deadly weapons, we have a problem. And I think we have to look at it in a multifaceted, non-ideological manner. Otherwise, this is going to continue. One last thing. Our community survived this, and so will Parkland. But these families that are affected, it never fully heals. It never does.
Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brian Levin, professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He joined us to talk about the mass shooting at a Florida school yesterday and the suspect's ties to a white nationalist group in that state. Right now, the latest Marvel superhero movie, Black Panther, out tomorrow, accomplishes a lot of firsts. First major superhero movie with an African protagonist, first with a majority black cast, first with a black writer-director. The movie's gained hype as a cultural phenomenon along the way. Twitter users are sharing stories with the hashtag WhatBlackPantherMeansToMe, like Twitter user MZ Shiel, who wrote, "My 7-year-old grandson exclaimed, 'Superheroes can be brown people, too?'" Here's actors Lupita Nyong'o and Sterling K. Brown talking about what the film means to them.
We have here a Marvel universe that is unapologetically black. It's so inspiring. It's an aspirational nation to see a world that could exist.
Man, this is a black superhero. It's happening. And to be on set and to see the level of production that is being put into this film and to see primarily a cast of African and African-American descent in front of the camera, it's historical. It moves me, like it moves me to tears. So I'm not only excited for that, but then Halloween, I can't wait to see little white kids dressing up as Black Panther, man. It's freaking dope.
Reggie Ugwu is with us now. He's a pop culture reporter for the New York Times. Reggie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you got to interview some of the stars of the movie for The Times. It seems like they really felt the significance of the film and the representation of African and African Americans in it. Do you share that? Is this a big deal?
Oh, I think it's a huge deal, and it's shocking in a way when you talk about the firsts that this movie represents in terms of it being the first superhero movie with a majority black cast and black director and writer. You know, in 2018, you would think that this would have happened by now. You know, we've had a black president, but the fact of the matter is it hasn't happened, and you have all of these millions of fans and black filmgoers who have been waiting for a long time for something like this. You know, obviously we've had, this is the 18th Marvel Universe movie, and is the first one that is a majority black. So I think that it's historic, as Sterling K. Brown was saying.
Can you talk about why this kind of representation matters? Because I think for the white audience, we've been seeing ourselves in superhero movies for a long time. It may not connect with us. Why this would be a big deal? Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, I think if you're a white person in America or really anywhere else in the world, then most of the movies that you see, you know, the characters look like you, and so you might not think about that. But if you're for black people, there's always a certain disconnect. There's a level of removal that you have when you're cheering for Iron Man or when you're cheering for Spider-Man. You know, you may identify with the character on so many levels, but at the end of the day, they don't really look like you, and you can't. And so there's a bit of distance there. So when you have someone who actually looks like you, who talks like you, and there's a lot of, you know, cultural reference points in this movie beyond just the color of the character's skin, you know, it connects in just in a much more visceral and intimate way. And then, you know, they say, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And so it sort of expands your horizon in terms of what you think is possible.
You mentioned the kind of downside here is, why did it take so long? Why do you think it is so only in 2018 that we're seeing something like this?
Right. You know, that's a question that I put to Kevin Feige, who's the president of Marvel Studios and the producer of this film. And you know, it's remarkable. But he was saying that, you know, it took this long. We had to, Marvel had to become this big. It had to become this successful. We had to have this much clout in order to take a gamble like this. And Disney, you know, which owns Marvel, has a bit of a history recently in making films with diverse casts. They did Queen of Katwe also with Lupita Nyong'o, and they have A Wrinkle in Time coming out from director Ava DuVernay. And so it wasn't until, the way he put it was, that they were able to sneak behind a bullet train. So you know, there's long-standing rumors and beliefs in Hollywood that if you put a movie out with a majority black cast, you're going to have a very limited appeal in the audience, and especially internationally. And this movie, you know, part of the miracle of it is that it's really disproving that with, you know, pre-sale tracking numbers that are breaking records.
Right, the movie actually isn't officially out until tomorrow. Can you talk about, I didn't know people pre-bought movies, movie tickets to that extent. I usually do it, you know, an hour before I go to the movie, if at all before. What are we seeing in the pre-release sales here?
Right, yeah, so, I mean, people are so excited about this movie that they've been buying tickets for months already and planning their outfits and talking about it on social media. It was one of the most talked about movies of last year on Twitter, even though it was still months from coming out. Right now they're saying it's on track to sell between $150 to $170 million at the box office in the opening weekend, which would be more than any other film to premiere at this time of year, and far more than any other debut movie for a Marvel superhero, including Iron Man and Captain America.
Talking to Reggie Ugwu, pop culture reporter for the New York Times, about tomorrow's release of the movie Black Panther and its representation of Africans and African Americans. And it's not just that there are lots of African and African Americans in the movie. People are talking about the roles and the diversity of roles they have. It's not the sidekick. It's not the victim or the sort of stock characters in a urban crime movie. Can you talk about the different roles we're seeing people in here?
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole spectrum. You know, it's just like you can go and see, you know, and many other of these kinds of movies, and most of the characters will be white. The hero will be white. The villain will be white. And there may be a sidekick character of color. It's exactly that, but just with black characters. And so on the one hand it's extremely novel. On the other hand, it's really familiar. And one of the things that happens when you have a cast that's predominantly black like this is, you know, race actually sort of recedes a little bit. It's not that the film itself doesn't actually talk that much about race. It's much more about identity. And so you really have a black hero, you have black villains, you have black sidekicks, and it is not just racial diversity, it's also gender diversity. It's some of the most important characters and most dynamic and scene-stealing characters in this film are the women. The women warriors played by Lupita Nyong'o and Danai Gurira, and there's a really funny character that's Black Panther's younger sister, played by Letitia Wright. And these characters have just as much screen time as the men do. So it's really a rich roles for women as well.
And this comes after a bunch of years of people, the movement Oscars So White, pointing out the lack of diversity in filmmaking. We've talked on this show over the years about annual reports showing a lack of diversity in filmmaking. Is this coming in part because people were raising this as an issue?
I don't know. I think if you were to ask, Kevin Feige, you know, whether or not, you know, a campaign like that is influencing his decisions, I don't know that he would agree. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I think this movie exists because there's huge demand for a movie like this that caters to black life. Black people in this country are overrepresented in the movie buying public. There are 15% of ticket buyers and only 12% of the population. And as we saw last year with the movie Girls Trip, which was a low budget film that ran away with the summer as one of the biggest hits of the year, or with Get Out, which made over $200 million, another low budget thriller that people didn't expect to be that successful. You know, these movies make a lot of economic sense. It's not just political correctness or any kind of liberal idealism.
Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. As great as this is for racial equality and gender equality, I'm hoping for a time when this is just the usual course of things.
Dennis, thanks. So yeah, when we have a movie with a mostly African or African American cast, and it's no big deal, Reggie. Do you think we're going to get there?
I certainly hope so. I think it's kind of shocking that we're having this milestone in 2018. I wish that there were a dozen movies like this that came out in every year, and that wouldn't have to be such a big deal.
Do you think Black Panther is going to pave the way for future representation in other movies if it's successful? And are we going to see a lot of the actors, already big names, coming into this movie being bigger names coming out of it?
I really think so. You never know. You can take anything for granted. But I think, especially coming off last year with the movies that I mentioned, I think it's very clear at this point that there's a huge market out there for these kinds of movies, and there's an audience that is waiting to see themselves represented on screen. And as far as, I think it's a good point to bring up the cast. A lot of these actors are really young and upcoming actors, people like Michael B. Jordan, who is really coming into his own, and Letitia Wright, who I mentioned, who's a new face, who I think is going to have a long career ahead of her. It's a new generation of actors, and the filmmaker as well, Ryan Coogler, who directed Creed previously to this. And so it's exciting to see that there's so much talent out there that's ready to rise to this moment.
And Reggie, did you get to preview this in your role as a pop culture reporter?
I did indeed.
And it's worth going out to see, would you say?
I would say so. It's got a 97% rating right now on Rotten Tomatoes, and I think if you like superhero movies, this is an extraordinary entry into the genre.
Reggie, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
That's Reggie Ugwu. He's a pop culture reporter at the New York Times with us to talk about the new movie Black Panther and its cultural impact. First, in 2015, a New York Times reporter spent a year documenting the lives of six New Yorkers. One was a gay man who had lost his partner a few years prior, another a Chinese immigrant with a love for playing Mahjong, another an African-American veteran of World War II. What all six of them had in common was age. They were all 85 years or older. 3 years later, the experience is continuing to shape the life of the reporter. John Leland is a writer for the New York Times, and the title of his new book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you, in one interview, describe yourself as having been a gloomy Gus for most of your life. I want to give a listen to another one, going back to the Seinfeld show. Here's George Costanza growing a bit frustrated, talking to an older man at a diner. Maybe we relate to the situation.
I'm grateful for every moment I have.
Grateful? How can you be grateful when you're so close to the end? When you know that any second, poof, bam, oh, it could all be over. I mean, you're not stupid. You can read the handwriting on the wall. It's a matter of simple arithmetic, for God's sake.
I guess I just don't care.
What are you talking about?
So, John, a lot of us may think of old age with some dread, as George Costanza did there, some fear. That is not what you encountered as you worked with the people you were writing about for that year.
Yeah, I have to say I can relate to George in that, not in his tone of voice or his
right.
particular language, but I did have those questions, and I got more nuanced answers from the people that I talked with, and they explained how it was that they were getting on with their lives. They all had some kind of setbacks or difficulties, and they all acknowledged that they were near the end of their lives. But none of them defined themselves by whatever losses they'd had. They really all lived for the things that they could still do.
Yeah, and this is not kind of a Pollyanna-ish denying the problems with aging. It was how they dealt with them. What kind of lessons did you start to get as you spent more and more time with them?
Well, the big one and the overarching one from which all the other lessons flow, I think, is that whatever stage of life we're in, whatever hardships we've had, we have some say in how we, what place we give them in our lives. We can make them the center of our lives and treat ourselves as that guy in the wheelchair, or we can think of ourselves as that father or that guy who likes to garden and happens to get around in a wheelchair. And the six people that I spent that year with all chose the latter. They just, I think, were reflexively drawn to it because, they don't expect their problems to all go away. They understand that there are problems, but they just don't want to live entirely in their problems.
I've talked to people who work with people suffering from Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and I keep hearing don't focus when you're talking to, say, a relative or other loved one. Don't focus on what's lost. Don't keep going to, don't you remember, don't you remember. Focus on what is still there, what you can still do with them. Is that a kind of lesson that you were getting from the people you worked with?
Yeah, exactly. There was a great study of Alzheimer's people or people with dementia in Britain a couple of years ago, and they gave this study the name, My Name is Not Dementia, because the people in the study didn't think that was the most important thing about them. That was just something they had, like brown hair or being tall or short.
Talking to John Leland. His new book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. John, can you share a couple stories from among the six people that you write about?
Well, the guy who first really got to me was Fred Jones. And Fred was the African-American veteran you mentioned. And Fred was 87 when I met him, and he was living alone in a walk-up apartment. And he was in the process of losing parts of two toes to an infection that was turning into gangrene. And his daughter was dying of breast cancer. When I said to Fred, you know, what's your favorite part of the day? Fred would never hesitate. He'd just get this big smile and say, waking up in the morning and saying, thank God for another day, on my way to 110. And I'm like Costanza in that. I didn't get it. I'm like, how can you, what do you have to be grateful for? And how can you want another 20 or 25 years of this? And over my time with Fred, I came to understand it, that gratitude, it wasn't just like being happy because somebody gives you something or does you a favor. It was a different way of looking at the world and seeing the world as a benign place that gives you things. And more often than not, it's on your side. And the things that we have to be grateful for, as Fred understood it, far outweighed the things that we had to regret.
Is it possible to cultivate that kind of mindset when you're not that age?
The great thing is that researchers who work with gratitude have tried this in experiments. And they'll just take ordinary people and say, why don't you try writing down three things you're grateful for in a day? And ask another group, why don't you just try to write down three things that happened to you in a day? And ask the third group, why don't you write down three ways in which you have it better than other people? And the people that just wrote down things that happened to them, they were about the same at the beginning of the study and at the end. And the people that wrote down ways in which they had things better than other people, had slight improvement. And the people who wrote down things that they were grateful for, they slept better, they exercised more regularly, they reported less stress or depression, they were more likely to do something for somebody else, for a stranger. And so, that was a short-term study, so we don't know what the effects of it long-term are. But at least in the short term, you can induce it deliberately.
Do you do this now?
I do. I don't have to do it deliberately because the time I spent with Fred, it just kind of worked by osmosis. And you have stories like Fred always cracked me up. He was that player. He's the guy who always had a dirty story or, pretended he could speak German or wanted to tell me about the flashy suits he used to wear. And like the first time I met him, we went to the supermarket and he cruised the cashiers to see who was the prettiest before checking out. And at the same time, half his stories would be about his church and wanting to be involved in this church, and the other half would be about sex. I never grew tired of being with Fred.
And the pop culture portrayal of an older person often is, I think, regret. Like if there was a character talking about the flashy suits they used to wear, it would be a sad moment. Like they don't have that anymore. You didn't get that?
I didn't. I mean, Fred wished he could still wear those suits, don't get me wrong. But he just moved on to his other life. This was what he was doing now, and he wanted more of it. He really was convinced he'd live to 110. I can say, alas, he didn't. He died in 2016. And I would mention that he died a week after his daughter died of breast cancer. And the social worker said he died of a broken heart. And I think that's probably true.
Now, going back to the beginning, this was just another assignment for you, right? You were going to go in, do this thing, write about it, done. You didn't expect this to change you.
I knew exactly what I was going to write about. I was going to write about the hardships of old age and how people fell down and then their life was over, or they got isolated from their families and they were depressed, or their memory started to slip. And I saw some of those things, don't get me wrong. But, again, there was so much more to their people's lives. And their lives weren't problems that they needed to fix. They were lives that they were going to live with some difficulties, but just like anybody at any age.
And one of the people you talked to did have that injury. I think it was an injured ankle, was it? And had that fearful moment. Like, is this the beginning of this downward spiral I've been worrying about?
Yeah, that's Ruth Willig, and she had a fall, and she dealt with her first fall, and then she's in a walking boot. And when she's in the walking boot, she had a second fall, and she hurt her hip at that point. And she thought, wow, this is the beginning of the end. This is how it ends. And that's a common thing. You know, if you're young and you fall down and hurt your hip, we think, how can you get better? And if you're old, we tend to think, oh, my God, this is the beginning of the end for Mom. And it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but we need to remember that older people get better, too.
We're talking about lessons learned from older people from writer and author John Leland. He's the writer behind a New York Times piece that followed the lives of six people aged 85 and up. He shares the lessons he learned in the new book, Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you aged 85 and up? Do you have a lesson maybe to share with us? Or is there someone older in your life that taught you something important, maybe inspiring? Or do you look at aging with fear, maybe dread? Are there lessons that might help you deal with that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. John, we hear a lot that we've been sorting ourselves out in American society lately. We spend more time talking to people similar to us politically, ethnically, racially, and I'm guessing by generation. Do you think we need more opportunities to talk to people, spend time together, even if it's not a year-long reporting assignment, with people of other generations?
Absolutely. I have to tell you, this has changed my life more than any work I've ever done. It's just, it really did change me from ER into this annoying bundle of joy that you hear on your radio today. And we do. I mean, we always think, oh, older people need people to talk to them. But it works in both directions. There's benefits there in both ways. And going into this, my mother's 89, and I always thought, you know, what are the things I need to do for my mother? What does she need from me? And it's tiring to have a relationship that goes all one way. I love my mother, and I was happy to do it, but it's exhausting. And as I got to know the others and really understand that what they were giving to me without me having to try to solve their problems, it changed my relationship with my mother. So I began to appreciate all I was getting from her out of the time we spent together. And people that don't get to spend time with elders are missing something. I mean, for almost all of human history, societies turn to their oldest members for wisdom. And now we have this strange social experiment where we've stopped doing that because we'd rather look on Google.
I want to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Stoughton. Bob, hi.
Bob is me.
Hi, Bob. What do you want to tell us about?
Oh, I was just telling the lady that I've been telling people recently that I'm 69, which we know we are, because you got to be 69 before you can be 94. But I have discovered that people treat me a lot different when I say, if they say how old, I just say 69, and right away, why they figure, well, he can carry that chair, or he can do this or that. They find out I'm 94. Everybody thinks I'm crippled.
Really? So they talk to you completely differently if you knock, is that 25 years off your age?
Yeah, they treat you a lot more normally. And when you get older, why they're afraid you're going to fall apart, I guess. Maybe I look bad, worse than I feel.
And so you do, obviously you're still having good conversations with people, even if you have to nudge your age.
We have a great time. I'm at Scallon here in Stoughton, and you couldn't find a better place to spend your time. It's really great. It's lots of people here, many, many people, and there's, you know, people come, people go, but it's really a good place to spend your old age. You're very highly respected here, but no matter who you are.
Bob, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. I appreciate that. And John, you know, Bob says people hear 80s, 90s and up. I think there's a stereotype. We build a whole story around that person that may not be accurate, that may affect the way we treat them.
Oh, my God. One of the things I heard most often was how annoyed people are by having younger people talk baby talk to them. Right. Oh, and how are we feeling today? Oh, 94 years young. Bless your heart. Hello, sweetie or honey. You know, I've lived 94 years. I want to, you know, I've learned some things. I've seen some things. I'm not sweetie. I'm not cute. I'm not like, how old are we today? And you know, across the board, that gets people upset.
Bob, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go next to Pat with us in Madison. Pat, hi.
Hi. I had the opportunity for my mom and my aunt to move to Madison as they were approaching their 90s, so that I could look after them a little bit better. And I was so pleased that they were brave enough to do that. In their upper 80s, and so they're both gone now. But what I really got from that was such an education and a kind of a gift that, you know, when you take time to really listen and have a relationship with somebody instead of just kind of doing for them as a caregiver, it's something that people who don't do it, they really miss out. And they were brave and they were, you know, reflective, and I miss them, but I actually kind of seek out a little bit of their old friends now, because it kind of rounds out my life. And I think people who don't take the step to maybe, you know, they get fearful about being a caregiver or something like that, I think they lose a piece.
Pat, I think going into that, people might worry this is going to be a chore, a burden, and I'm sure it was a fair amount of work from time to time on your part, but you didn't go into it with that attitude of this is a burden on me, it sounds like.
I had no idea what I was in for, actually. I kind of thought, oh, it'll be good, it'll be easy, because they're not going to be an hour and a half away. But, you know, I was retired, just freshly retired, and I was able to, you know, take the time, and that was my retirement, and I just embraced it and never resented it, and it's a great chapter.
Pat, thank you so much for sharing that story. John, what do you think when you hear Pat?
It's a really hard job, and I admire the caregivers so much. I mean, they're the heroes of this story, but it also is a much more rewarding job than people often think. And Pat's like, I love hearing that, how much she got out of it and how much the people gave her, even when you could look at it from the outside and say she's just doing things for them. It's not that way. She's learning from them, and they're showing her how to be resilient. And not only that, who else is going to show you how to be old but somebody who's done it?
Pat, thanks so much for sharing your story. We're talking to John Leland. His new book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. I want to get the origin of the title, Happiness is a Choice That You Make. John, where did that come from?
Well, it came, the words kind of went into my head one day, and I wrote them down in a little piece of paper and taped it up by the side of my bed before I'd written a word of the book. And they were the first words I saw in the morning and the last words I saw before I went to bed. And I started to reflexively choose to be happy. I had my problems. My problems didn't change. Maybe they're a little worse than when I was younger or more severe than when I was younger. But I can just see through them now and put them in perspective. If I have setbacks, I don't take them personally, and I don't blow them up. I don't worry about things that might happen but haven't yet. There was a wonderful line from Jonas Mekas in it. He says, I never worry, because why worry about something when it's not happening? And then when it's happening, why worry? You deal with it. You spend all your time worrying, and it may not even happen what you think. And he says, nothing is hopeless. I don't even know the meaning of the word, hopeless. And he turned 95 on Christmas Eve, and I don't go a week now without quoting that line to myself. And this year especially, when the news has been so dark and really unpleasant a lot of times, it's been wonderful to have those words greeting me every morning and every night.
And John, I should say, this isn't just anecdotes. You also looked at research on happiness and aging, and yeah, surveys seem to bear out what you saw talking to this group of individuals.
Yeah, the studies have been consistent for years that older people are more content than, you know, as much as we idealize youth and hard bodies and firm skin, older people are more content, they're less stressed, they're less afraid of death. And a thing that's important is they're able to sustain mixed feelings, meaning that they can see the joy or the good in something even when there's pain or loss. And that's life.
And you talked about, you know, you were an ER before this. I mean, is it hard keeping up this attitude of gratitude, if I could use the phrase? Do you slip back into some of your pre-project ways?
Well, of course, I have bad days like everybody else, and some are internal, and sometimes bad things come my way. But as I say, when they do, I don't personalize them in the way I used to, and I don't overstate them. And so when those things happen, you get over them quickly. You don't get mad because it rained on a day that you had a picnic planned. You just say, well, rain, that falls. And all the older people were like that because they didn't expect things to go well for them every day. And so they didn't get, you know, knocked off their bearings when they didn't.
Can you give us leave us with just a bit of advice on how we get from maybe where we are now to a little more of that attitude?
Yes. Don't personalize your hardships. Practice gratitude. And don't treat things that haven't happened as if they have. And have some courage. I'm going to leave you with the story of Helen and Howie, who are one of the couples in the book, or the couple in the book, and they met in a nursing home. And they had the courage to love each other, even knowing that they probably wouldn't be able to do so for long, and one of them would probably watch the other one die. And I'm just astounded day after day by their courage. And this is the day after Valentine's Day. I salute Helen and Howie.
John, thank you so much for sharing that story and all of your reporting with us.
Oh, thanks so much.
We've been talking to John Leland. He's told us about lessons he learned from following the lives of six people over the age of 85. It started off as a, you know, usual reporting assignment, turned into something that he says changed his life. He ultimately wrote a book based on his work for the New York Times on this. The book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. You can still share your stories, your thoughts on the wisdom maybe that you've gained while aging, the gratitude you have. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you're like me, and I hope you are, you like soup a lot. You like eating it, and if you're a cook, you like making it. Well, here's a little sneak preview. Tomorrow on Food Friday at roughly this time, we're going to talk to our own Lori Skelton about ways to up your soup game. I make a lot of soup. I tend to make the same kinds of soup again and again. I got three or four favorites, maybe with some little variations. Well, Lori is one of our mad scientists here when it comes to cooking. She's been experimenting. Soups inspired from, I think, South Asia. I missed the one from Czechoslovakia or former Czechoslovakia, a Czech-style soup with dried fruit in it. I was off that day, unfortunately, so I missed it. We're going to get some great soup advice, great way to get us through the last few weeks of winter here. And you can help get us started right now. Do you have a favorite soup that you like to eat or make? Do you have a recipe you'd like to tell us about, a key ingredient? Tell us about it on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got a link up there already. Tell us your favorite soup, and you can get your questions in early for Lori, too. Again, share your favorite soups or your soup-related questions for tomorrow's Food Friday with Lori Skelton on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stick around. More to come today on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network.